Okay, so last time we did the overview of Judges, you remember, and as I mentioned, we're going to come back and we're going to just kind of zero in on some of the key events, some of the key people. So tonight we're going to look at the story of Gideon. So we're going to spend our time together looking at the story of Gideon. What I want to do, Gideon covers, what is it, chapter 6, 7, 8, 9, or 9 is kind of a continuation of the story with Gideon's sons. But so what I want to do is I want to actually read chapter 6 and 7. Just read us the story. It's just it's worth reading. And then I want to come back and look for the application, look for the lessons, look for the things that we can take away from that. All right. So that's how we'll do it tonight. And Judges chapter 6, verse 1. The Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord, and for 7 years he gave them into the hand of the Midianites. Because the power of Midian was so oppressive, the Israelites prepared shelters for themselves in mountain clefts, caves, and strongholds. Whenever the Israelites planted their crops, the Midianites, Amalekites, and other eastern peoples invaded the country. They camped on the land and ruined the crops all the way to Gaza and did not spare a living thing for Israel, neither sheep nor cattle nor donkeys. They came up with their livestock and their tents like swarms of locusts. It was impossible to count them or their camels. They invaded the land to ravage it. Midian so impoverished the Israelites that they cried out to the Lord for help. When the Israelites cried out to the Lord because of Midian, he sent them a prophet who said, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. I brought you up out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. I rescued you from the hand of the Egyptians, and I delivered you from the hand of all your oppressors. I drove them out before you and gave you their land. I said to you, I am the Lord your God. Do not worship the gods of the Amorites in whose land you live, but you have not listened to me." Then the angel of the Lord came and sat down under the oak in Ophrah that belonged to Joash the Abiezrite, where his son Gideon was threshing wheat in a wine press to keep it from the Midianites. When the angel of the Lord appeared to Gideon, he said, "The Lord is with you, mighty warrior." "Pardon me, my lord," Gideon replied, "but if the Lord is with us, why has all this happened to us? Where are all his wonders that our ancestors told us about when they said, 'Did not the Lord bring us up out of Egypt?' But now the Lord has abandoned us and given us into the hand of Midian." The Lord turned to him and said, "Go in the strength you have and save Israel out of Midian's hand. Am I not sending you?" "Pardon me, my lord," Gideon replied, "but how can I save Israel? My clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least in my family." The Lord answered, "I will be with you, and you will strike down all the Midianites, leaving none alive." Gideon replied, "If now I have found favor in your eyes, give me a sign that it is really you talking to me. Please do not go away until I come back and bring my offering and set it before you." And the Lord said, "I will wait until you return." And Gideon went inside, prepared a young goat, and from an ephah flour he made bread without yeast. Putting the meat in a basket and its broth in a pot, he brought them out and offered them to him under the oak. The angel of God said to him, "Take the meat and the unleavened bread, place them on this rock, pour out the broth." And Gideon did so. Then the angel of the Lord touched the meat and the unleavened bread with the tip of the staff that was in his hand. Fire flared from the rock, consuming the meat and the bread, and the angel of the Lord disappeared. When Gideon realized that it was the angel of the Lord, he exclaimed, "Alas, sovereign Lord, I have seen the angel of the Lord face to face." But the Lord said to him, "Peace, Do not be afraid. You are not going to die. So Gideon built an altar to the Lord there and called it, The Lord is Peace. To this day, it stands in Ophrah of the Abiezrites. That same night, the Lord said to him, take the second bull from your father's herd, the one 7 years old, tear down your father's altar to Baal and cut down the Asherah pole beside it. Then build a proper kind of altar to the Lord your God on the top of this height. Using the wood of the Asherah pole that you cut down, offer the second bull as a burnt offering. So Gideon took 10 of his servants and did as the Lord told him, but because he was afraid of his family and the townspeople, he did it at night rather than in the daytime. In the morning, when the people of the town got up, there was Baal's altar demolished with the Asherah pole beside it cut down and the second bull sacrificed on the newly built altar. They asked each other, who did this? When they carefully investigated, they were told, Gideon, son of Joash, did it. The people of the town demanded of Joash, bring your son. He must die because he has broken down Baal's altar and cut down the Asherah pole beside it. But Joash replied to the hostile crowd around him, are you going to plead Baal's cause? Are you trying to save him? Whoever fights for him shall be put to death by morning. If Baal really is a god, he can defend himself when someone breaks down his altar. So because Gideon broke down Baal's altar, they gave him the name Jerubbaal that day, saying, let Baal contend with him. Now all the Midianites, Amalekites, and other eastern people joined forces and crossed over the Jordan and camped in the valley of Jezreel. Then the Spirit came upon Gideon, and he blew a trumpet summoning the Abiezrites to follow him. He sent messengers throughout Manasseh, calling them to arms, and also to Asher, Zebulun, and Naphtali, so that they too went up to meet them. Gideon said to God, if you will save Israel by my hand, as you have promised, look, I will place a wool fleece on the threshing floor. If there is dew only on the fleece and all the ground is dry, then I will know that you will save Israel by my hand, as you said. And that is what happened. Gideon rose early the next day. He squeezed the fleece and wrung out the dew, a bowl full of water. Then Gideon said to God, do not be angry with me. Let me make just one more request. Allow me one more test with the fleece. But this time, make the fleece dry and let the ground be covered with dew. That night, God did so. Only the fleece was dry. All the ground was covered with dew. And so early in the morning, Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, and all his men camped at the spring of Harod. The camp of Midian was north of them in the valley near the hill of Moreh. The Lord said to Gideon, you have too many men. I cannot deliver Midian into their hands, or else Israel would boast against me. My own strength has saved me, they would say. Now announce to the army, anyone who trembles with fear may turn back and leave Mount Gilead. So 22,000 men left, while 10,000 remained. But the Lord said to Gideon, there are still too many men. Take them down to the water, and I will thin them out for you there. If I say, this one shall go with you, he shall go. But if I say, this one shall not go with you, he shall not go. So Gideon took the men down to the water. There the Lord told him, separate those who lap the water with their tongues as a dog laps from those who kneel down to drink. 300 of them drank from cupped hands, lapping like dogs. All the rest got down on their knees to drink. The Lord said to Gideon, with the 300 men that lapped, I will save you and give the Midianites into your hands. Let all the others go home. So Gideon sent the rest of the Israelites home, but he kept the 300 who took over the provisions and trumpets of the others. Now the camp of Midian lay below him in the valley. During the night, the Lord said to Gideon, get up and go down against the camp, because I am going to give it into your hands. If you are afraid to attack, go down to the camp with your servant Purah and listen to what they are saying. Afterward, you will be encouraged to attack the camp. So he and Purah, his servant, went down to the outpost of the camp. The Midianites, the Amalekites, and all the other eastern people had settled in the valley, thick as locusts. Their camels could no more be counted than the sand on the seashore. Gideon arrived just as a man was telling his friend his dream. "I had a dream," he was saying. "A round loaf of barley bread came tumbling into the Midianite camp. It struck the tent with such force that the tent overturned and collapsed." His friend responded, "This can be nothing other than the sword of Gideon, son of Joash, the Israelite. God has given the Midianites, the whole camp, into his hand." And when Gideon heard the dream and its interpretation, he bowed down and worshiped. He returned to the camp of Israel and called out, "Get up. The Lord has given us the Midianite camp. He's given it into our hands." Dividing the 300 men into three companies, he placed trumpets and empty jars in the hands of all of them with torches inside. "Watch me," he told them, "follow my lead. When I get to the edge of the camp, do exactly as I do. When I and all who are with me blow our trumpets, then from all around the camp, blow yours and shout for the Lord and for Gideon." Gideon and 100 men with him reached the edge of the camp at the beginning of the middle watch, just after they had changed the guard. They blew their trumpets and broke the jars that were in their hands. Three companies blew the trumpets and smashed the jars. Grasping the torches in their left hands and holding in their right hands the trumpets they were to blow, they shouted, "The sword of the Lord and Gideon." And while each man held his position around the camp, all the Midianites ran, crying out as they fled. And when the 300 trumpets sounded, the Lord caused the men throughout the camp to turn on each other with their swords. The army fled to Beth Shitta toward Zerah, as far as the border of Abel-Meholah near Tabbath. Israelites from Naphtali, Asher, and all Manasseh were called out, and they pursued the Midianites. And Gideon sent messengers throughout the hill country of Ephraim, saying, "Come down against the Midianites and seize the waters of the Jordan ahead of them as far as Beth Barah." So all the men of Ephraim were called out, and they seized the waters of the Jordan as far as Beth Barah. They also captured two of the Midianite leaders, Oreb and Zeb. They killed Oreb at the rock of Oreb and Zeb at the winepress of Zeb. They pursued the Midianites and brought the heads of Oreb and Zeb to Gideon, who was by the Jordan. Okay, so that's the story. And then chapter 8, just a quick summary of chapter 8. They continue to pursue two of the kings, and they overtake the kings, and they execute them, and they go on to a great victory. So, but as we look at the story, there's a number of things that I want to remind us of. Well, first of all, the Midianites. The Midianites and the Amalekites, these are peoples that were, they were sort of like nomadic tribes. They never really had cities. They didn't have a capital, but there were regions that they dominated. And so if you were to go today, like we did a couple years ago, we went to what the Israelis call Eilat, and what the Arabs call Aqaba. And as you cross over to the other side of the sea there, that region back there was where the where these tribes dwelt. And they would kind of drift down as far as what we know today as Arabia, and they would also go up north into Jordan, or into maybe even close to where Amman is. So they were nomadic. So they wandered, but they definitely had these regions that they sort of dominated. And so at this time, now, remember we talked about how Judges is, when we talk about these seasons of oppression, we're not talking about necessarily one people like the Midianites oppressing all of the Israelites, but they were oppressing a certain number of the tribes. And so we're really reading about the tribes up there, up in the north area. So that's where all of this was taking place. So, but a few things that I want to just point out to us. Number one, what we see here and what we see over and over again is that Israel brought their troubles upon themselves by turning away from the Lord. So remember, the book of Judges is just, it is the whole story all the way through Judges is so depressing because it's just one oppressive situation after another, but it's all self-inflicted. It's all due to their turning away from the Lord. It's due to their rebellion against God. It's due to their refusal to submit to him and obey him, and their longing to be like the other people and to engage in the worship of the other nations. So these things are always self-inflicted. But we see that God is still merciful even for those whose wounds are self-inflicted. And we see that God, as they cried out to him, he would, in his mercy, he would send them deliverers. So now Gideon is another one of those deliverers that he sends. Now, when you look at Gideon, as we read through the story there in chapter 6, did you notice that Gideon wasn't the most promising prospect? You know, it's like, when you look at his response, first of all, he's totally skeptical. So, you know, the Lord speaks to him and says, you know, you're a mighty man of God, you're a great warrior, and you're going to give a victory to Israel. And he's very skeptical. He's like, you know, where's all the great things that we heard that God did for us? I mean, I haven't seen any of those things. You know, I heard about them, God, you know, bringing us out of Egypt and all of that. But we don't see any of that today. So Gideon's not a man like full of faith. He's a man full of skepticism. He just doesn't really see how anything's going to change. I mean, you know, where is this God that I've heard about is pretty much what he's saying. Not only is he skeptical, but by his own admission, he's a pretty insignificant person. So when the Lord tells him, no, you're going to be the one. You're going to go in the strength that I'm going to give you, and you're going to save Israel. And he's like, how is that going to happen? Because I belong to the most insignificant tribe, and I'm the least person in my family. So he didn't see himself as any great candidate for the job that God was calling him to. And then we see also that he was reluctant. He didn't jump at the opportunity. He was reluctant, and so he had to, he wanted to test everything. And so the first test is, okay, if this is really you, God, if you're speaking to me, then I'm going to go and I'm going to get an offering. I'm going to bring it back. You wait here. And when I come back with the offering, you know, if you're still here, then I'll know that it really is you. And of course he did that. And we read there how the Lord was there. He took his staff, consumed the offering with a fire that came out of the rock. And suddenly Gideon's like, I'm going to die. I saw God. And the Lord speaks peace to him. And so we see there the reluctance on his part. And we see it all the way through the story, right? It's not just there. It continues on. But what we also see is, so you got Gideon on the one hand, who's reluctant, who is insignificant in his own eyes, who's skeptical. But then you've got God. And look at the Lord. The Lord is like affirming. And as I was looking at this and just thinking about how God speaks to Gideon, you know, it's like the Lord just sort of doesn't even pay any attention to what Gideon's saying. He just says, the Lord is with you, mighty warrior. And Gideon's like, pardon me? I mean, you know, what do you mean the Lord's with me? But God just keeps pressing in. Go in the strength you have and save Israel out of Midian's hand. Am I not sending you? And then in verse 16, I will be with you and I will strike down all the Midianites. So you see, the Lord is affirming Gideon. God's just telling him, look, we're going to do this. I'm going to do it. In a sense, he's not taking no for an answer. He's just telling him this is what we're going to do. So he's affirming, and of course, we see that he's patient. And as we go on and we read through, we see the patience of God because, you know, Gideon says, okay, let me do this test. And then he does it. And the Lord confirms that it is indeed him. But then what happens? He comes to another place where, let's do this now. Let's take this fleece of wool and, you know, we'll put it on the threshing floor. And if this is really you speaking to me, then, you know, make the fleece be wet, but the ground dry. And God does it. But then what happens? Well, could we try it the other way? Could we just like, so we see the patience of God. And we also see that God is accommodating to our weakness. He's accommodating to Gideon's weakness. You know, there's not a place here where the Lord says, he doesn't really reprimand him for his need for more confirmation. God just is, you know, patiently accommodating his request. So when he comes back with that second request, can we just do it the opposite way now? Okay, sounds fine. The Lord lets it happen just as Gideon needed it to happen. But then as he finally convinces him to go and, you know, he's moving in that direction, what does the Lord say? Okay, I got one more thing to encourage you. Go down to the camp and just listen to what they're talking about. And he gets down there and, you know, the guy's sharing his dream. I mean, think about just how crazy that would have been. He's down at the enemy's camp. One guy just starts telling another guy about his dream about a barley loaf rolling into the tent of Midian and just crushing everything. And the guy goes, oh, I know what that is. That's Gideon. That's the sword of Gideon. And you can imagine. The guy probably thought, what? What is that? How does that relate to Gideon? But you can be sure that Gideon was the encouragement that he needed. That's what God brought to him. Now, in this story, like many of these stories, as we go through this portion of Scripture, one of the things that stands out are God's unconventional ways. You know, we saw that when we looked at the conquering of Jericho. Remember how we talked about how unconventional that was? The priests and everybody marching around the city for those days silently. And then on the final day, marching around seven times, blowing the trumpets and all, and the walls collapsing. Unconventional. God does things, not just then, but still today, in ways that just seem completely different than what we would think. And that's a consistent pattern with the Lord. All throughout biblical history, and there are many that can testify all throughout church history that the same thing is true, that God just, he does things unconventionally. Now, when you look at the forces of the Midianites, the Amalekites, all of the people from the east, their army was at least 135,000 strong. We know that because when you read in chapter 8, it gives you that 120,000 of them fell in battle, and when the kings fled, they fled with 15,000. So we know that they had at least 135,000, but it's more than likely that they had 150,000 to 200,000 man army. And so Gideon, in his first effort to get a fighting force together, he's able to gather 32,000 men. So let's just think of 32,000 versus, we'll just go with the lowest number, the one that's in the passage, 135,000. So they're pretty severely outnumbered at this point. And remember, they are under the oppression of the Midianites. They're hiding in caves. They're living in the clefts of the mountains. It's not like they've got any state-of-the-art weaponry. You know, I mean, they're kind of just a pitiful ragtag band. And obviously, that's the case because we were told what their weapons were. Their weapons were a jar, a lamp, and a torch. So, but they got 32,000. But God says, that's too many. And so they narrow it down by just letting anybody that wants to leave, leave. 22,000 leave. So now they've got 10,000. Now, put yourself in Gideon's shoes. I mean, at 32,000, you're already feeling like this is never going to work. We're totally outnumbered. Now you got 10. And then God comes back and says, you still have too many. And notice the reasoning that the Lord gave. Because if I gave the victory to these 10,000, Israel would boast that they had won the battle themselves. So God is going to make this thing so obvious that he is the one who's done this, that there's never going to be a question about it. And so the army is reduced to 300. Think about that. Okay, let's think about us in here tonight. You know, maybe there's 300 of us in here tonight. And let's think of us, and let's think of one of the large stadiums in the country, and every single seat is filled. And we have to go to battle against them. And they've got all of the state-of-the-art weapons. They've got everything that a fighting force could want. And we don't have anything. We've got a hymnal. We got our Bibles we can throw at them. You know, that's kind of the equivalent. But those are the numbers. That's what it would look like. So God reduces it to 300. How unconventional is that? But the way God ends up giving them the initial victory, the thrust that would give them the final victory, was that he intervenes and he turns, as we saw, he turns the enemy upon themselves. As they blow the trumpets, as they break the jars, and as they wave around the torches, this somehow creates a confusion that causes them to turn against each other and start slaying one another. And so God, very unconventionally, gives the victory to them. And like I said, let's just keep that in mind, that as you think about life and as you think about serving God and as you think about the struggles and challenges that you face, let's just keep in mind that God still works unconventionally. And let's remember that he's not limited to the way we think. And because what we so often do is we have a situation, we have a problem, we have a challenge, you know, whatever it might be. And in our minds, we see maybe, you know, just a few ways that this can be solved, this can be sorted out. And so we think of it very conventionally. We think of it like everybody would think of it. Like, well, yeah, I mean, here's your problem. You know, you ask 10 people, this is my problem. How do you think we solve it? You ask 10 people, they all basically say the same thing. Oh, well, a problem like that, you solve it like this. So then we end up trapped in that world of thinking that, okay, this is my problem, and now God, you got to make this happen, that one thing. Or you got, or maybe there's a couple of options. Or you, Lord, you either got to do this, or you got to do this, or you got to do this to solve this problem. But the truth is, God doesn't have to do any of them. God has a completely different set of options that we don't know anything about. And oftentimes, that's what he does. He uses the option that we would never think of. So that when it's done, we know who did it. We realize like that had to be the Lord. That it, you know, that doesn't make sense. How did it work out? And then as we see how God orchestrated those things, we realize, you know, his hand really was in that. Lately, I've just been thinking myself about this kind of stuff and just the unconventionality of God in working. And I find that I myself sometimes I just get stuck with thinking in one direction and about how God, you know, will do things, will provide, will accomplish, whatever it might be. And I've found myself recently kind of stepping back a little bit and saying, wait a second, I don't want to be trapped in that thinking. I want to be expecting God to work unconventionally. I want to expect that the problem probably isn't going to get solved the way I thought it was going to, because that's too conventional. God probably has a completely different way of doing things. So for me, that's kind of translated into just lately and just in some of my own experiences and my own ministry and things that I'm involved in. It's caused me to just say, okay, Lord, I don't have to try to make this happen or that happen, or I don't have to think that this is the only way that this can be accomplished. Lord, I'm just going to believe that you can do it in any way that you want. And I'm finding myself looking for those kinds of things that are just reminding me that God did this. I'm looking for those things where I can say, man, you know, the Lord stepped in, and there's no question that it was the Lord, because we were outnumbered 300 to, you know, 150,000, and God gave us the victory. So those kinds of things. And listen, we all have to recognize that. These things are written down not just to tell us what happened back then, but to show us how God works. And that's, the New Testament reminds us that the stories in the Old Testament are there for a number of reasons, but one of them certainly is so that we can see how God worked with people in the past and know that that's how he still works with people today. You know, I think with the passing of Billy Graham and the big memorial service for him last week and all of that. And there's been a lot of focus there, a lot of attention there. And as I've spent some time over the past couple weeks just thinking more about Billy's life and, you know, reading things and watching video clips and watching the memorial service and all of that, this kind of thing that I'm talking about has just been coming out to me where, you know, this very ordinary man in so many ways is responsible for so many extraordinary things, but he really isn't responsible for them. God did those things through him. And the thing that really struck me, and it actually just moved me to tears, when I saw his gravestone, and I don't know if you saw a picture of his gravestone or not, but the thing that really struck me was this, that just the simplicity of it. You know, on his gravestone, there's a cross, and then it just simply says Billy Graham. And then at the bottom, it says, a preacher of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And the reason why that so struck me is because, you know, it could have read something like the greatest preacher of the gospel of the 20th century. It could have read something like the greatest preacher of the gospel in the history of the world. You know, it could have read like that. And justifiably, it could have read like that. But the thing that really struck me as well was that Billy planned all of this in advance, and that's what he wanted on his tombstone. A preacher of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Just one of the thousands that have gone before him and the others that are still living and the ones that will come in the future. Not taking any special accolades or wanting any special recognition. But it just goes back to this whole idea of here's a guy who did so many extraordinary things. So many things happened through his life and ministry so unconventionally that at the end, you had to just say, God is the explanation for all of that. And I want that in my life as a Christian. And that's how we ourselves, you know, whatever we're doing for the Lord, that we could just have that sense that, you know, God is with us and he's working. And he can do anything. And he can do it in ways that we'd never dreamed he could do it. And we just would trust him to do what he promised to do. And not get hung up on the limitation that we put on it because we are thinking conventionally. We're thinking, well, God's got to do this, but you know, obviously he's got to do it this way because it's the only way to do it. So when you looked at the situation with Gideon and the Midianites, who beside God would say, you have too many men in your army. You need 300. Who but God would ever say anything like that? Nobody. No human being would have ever concluded that that was the way to overthrow the Midianites. And so that is a principle, I think, that we should all apply to our lives. Now, as you go on in the story, so as I mentioned in the 8th chapter, there's the kings, Zeba and Zalmunna, and they're the ones that Gideon pursues. They're the ones that the 15,000 are following, and they finally overtake them, and Gideon slays them. And in verse 22, we come to kind of the end of the story of Gideon, and it says this. Chapter 8, verse 22, it says, the Israelites now, after all, everything was said and done, the Israelites said to Gideon, rule over us, you, your son, your grandson, because you saved us from the hand of Midian. But Gideon told them, I will not rule over you, nor will my son rule over you. The Lord will rule over you. And he said, I do have one request, that each of you give me an earring from your share of the plunder. For it was the custom of the Ishmaelites to wear gold earrings. They answered, we will be glad to give them. So they spread out a garment, and each of them threw a ring from his plunder onto it. The weight of the gold ring he asked for came to 1,700 shekels, not counting the ornaments, the pendants, and the purple garments worn by the kings of Midian, or the chains that were on their camels. So I'm not going to be your king. God's going to rule over you, but give me these gold earrings. And so they agreed to do it. And Gideon made the gold into an ephod, which he placed in Ophrah, his town, and all Israel prostituted themselves by worshiping it there. And here's the saddest note, and it became a snare to Gideon and his family. So here's a guy who has this great success. He is used by God to bring a great victory. He even refuses to be their king, is what they're really asking him for. And he says, no, I'm not going to do it. The Lord's going to rule over you. But this gold he has a desire for this gold, and he creates an ephod, which is like a, it would have been like a some sort of a garment, but it would have been like a decoration sort of a piece. But for whatever reason, all of Israel prostituted themselves after it. So it basically became an idol. And it became an idol, and somehow they sought to worship God through this idol. God forbid this. They sought to do this, and it became a snare to Gideon and to his family as well. And so with Gideon, like so many of these other stories that we encounter as we make our way through the history, with Gideon, you have a cautionary tale. Because what the story reminds us of is that even after being used greatly by God, we're still vulnerable to pride. We're still vulnerable to idolatry. We're still vulnerable to getting caught up in things that we shouldn't be involved in. And really, what I want us to take away here is that we can never drop our guard. We can never drop our guard. And that's what Gideon did. He dropped his guard. The victory, they won it, and it was all good. And now we just relax, and we've got this ephod, and everything's good. But they drift away from the Lord. They drift back into idolatry. And as we see, as we carry on with the story, they end up back once again under oppressive powers. And so let's know this, that past victories are no guarantee of future success. This is the problem that happens so often. Because we've had success in the past, we assume that we will always have success. And we can become careless, and we can drop our guard, and this is what we can't forget. And I had this week. I had something that happened that kind of just, you know, was a bit of a wake up for me, and it was a wake up in regard to just remembering that we are in a battle. We are in a battle, and it is truly a life and death struggle with Satan and the forces of darkness. And if we forget that for any amount of time, then we are basically getting set up for some kind of a fall. We have got to just constantly be on the alert. We've got to remember that this is a war zone. And as much as, you know, we love the joy and we love all the exciting things and, you know, we're having a great time serving God, that's all part of it and that's wonderful. But we can't forget, well, actually, we're on the battlefield. We're in a battle. And I think even just, you know, hearing what our guest shared with us tonight, it kind of you know, takes us out of our world here and reminds us that, you know, there's such intense things happening all over the planet. And it's all, in one way or another, it's all just a manifestation of this reality of the great cosmic battle between God and the forces of darkness. And we're right in it. We're part of it. And so we cannot afford, like Gideon mistakenly did, to go into comfort mode after his victory, because that, in the end, led him into idolatry. And so God, help us to guard our hearts and to just keep before our minds that we are in a battle. And we've got to, as the scripture says, we've got to make sure we put on that whole armor of God. regularly, consistently, daily. Final thing, Gideon is another reminder of how much we all need the gospel and the power of the Spirit. And that's really what a lot of these stories will bring us back around to. They're, you know, these are the heroes of the faith. When you go to the New Testament, you go to Hebrews, you go to chapter 11, you got the Hall of Faith there. Gideon's right there. But every one of those heroes of the faith, what you see is that each and every one of them were thoroughly human. They had their great moments of faith and they had their great exploits, but they also had those weaknesses that just remind us that the gospel is necessary for every one of us. That apart from Jesus and his blood that was shed and his blood that cleanses us from all sin, and apart from the empowering of the Spirit, God's Spirit dwelling in us and enabling us to have victory over these things, apart from that, we don't have any hope of success. But because of that, we have every confidence that we will continue to move forward. And even if and when we do have those times of lapsing, or those times of turning back, or those times of failure, that because of what Jesus did, we can come directly right there to that throne of grace and receive the mercy and the grace to help in the time of need.